And welcome to the Link 2013 Ignite Link Updates and Programs course on what's new in Link Mobile. I'm Link Aaron Mobile. Steele, and I'm joined by Brian Ricks.
Hi, everyone.
So I'm Aaron Steele. I'm a senior consultant with Microsoft Consulting Services. I've been with us for about 3 years, and I'm focused primarily on Link and specifically on voice. I've been in computers and sort of overall technology for about 18 years or so. I live in Chicago with my wife and two kids. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Brian.
Sure. Brian Ricks. I own and operate Brightcom Computers, an independent consulting firm. We do IT architecture, typically Microsoft, and lately unified messaging and UC kind of structured. Been an MVP since 2006 in Microsoft Link, been using LCS since 2003, designing and implementing, and became recently a Microsoft Certified Solutions Master's in Communication. Been doing this in general of IT for over 20 years, and of those 20 years, it's been a big portion of it being UC and mobility. So, independent since 2009, and yeah.
Great,
that's
thanks.
It.
So setting the expectations for this course, really we are looking for IT and telecom professionals who design, plan, deploy, and maintain solutions for UC, Link specifically. We're really looking at experienced professionals who are looking to better understand the new features of Link 2013 since it went RTM. We've got a couple of suggested resources here if you need to learn about Link 2013. We have the 2336 and 2337 courses that you can take, which will lead you towards getting your solutions expert in communications exam by taking, you know, the 7336 and 7337 exams. There's some learning partners you can, you know, go contract with and sort of figure out how to learn these things, and we hope that to help you learn these updates. In this course, what we'll be talking about is what's new in Link Mobile. We'll start with a quick little recap of what the Link Windows 8 client, Link Mobile 2013 sort of brought to us. We'll talk about the features since those released. We'll talk about some architecture and scenarios. We'll talk a bit about Link Mobile on Wi-Fi and sort of why that matters. And we'll give you a few troubleshooting tips before closing out the course.
Alrighty.
So with Link Windows 8 client and Link Windows Mobile as the recap, sort of as a refresher, we released Link Mobile 2013 in March of 2013, and we released the store app first in October of 2012. Our real goals with those were cross-platform support. We wanted you to be able to work on any device that you choose and really in those different form factors. We really did want to release a product that would core and focus on the power of real-time communications. We were looking for you to be able to choose anytime, anywhere access for yourself. We optimized for the mobile constraints. That is, it's a unified experience across all the mobile platforms, but it is optimized for those devices and those form factors that you're choosing to use. And lastly, we wanted to simplify the deployment from Link 2010. In Link 2010, there was that separate add-on and separate install. In 2013, it comes out of the box when you choose to install the updates. The new Link, as we've said, is designed to work across all these platforms. It works from the PC through the Mac through the smartphone, tablet platforms, and all the way into the browser, and we're trying to really capture all those in that unified look and feel, but optimized for those platforms and how they support the technology.
Right, so they won't necessarily be the same, but they will feel the same and have the capabilities that those platforms present.
Exactly. So in the Link Windows 8 client, what we brought to you was voice and video, voice over IP and video. In some of the platforms, we brought multi-view video. We brought one-click meeting join in that Windows 8 client app. We brought contacts, presence, instant messaging, and viewing of shared content when it was released. But the truth is, that wasn't the end of where we were going.
Well, yeah, and you can tell there's a box missing on the left-hand side. Right?
There is.
A tile is not present, so there must be something more.
There is. There's things that we wanted to add, and we'll get to that when we update it. From a Link Mobile 2013 sort of feature set, when we released that in February, we brought the basics. We brought contacts, presence, voice over IP and video on mobile clients, one-click meeting join, call via work, view shared PowerPoint slides on an iPad. It was great. You know, and it all relied on that new UCWA infrastructure, and it changed from being it changed the push notification structure a little bit. It's different on some of the iPad platforms than it is on some of the Windows platforms. There's different requirements, but that's sort of getting a little too deep into this from a technical.
Right, and really that one of the key changes, that of the UCWA and the way that it's now handled in the back end, and it's significantly different and more robust than the old MCX architecture.
Most definitely. So now we get into some of the new features since the release of 2013. So those new features for the Windows 8 client really come down to anonymous join was added in. We gave you an updated meetings environment. There was asynchronous PowerPoint slide navigation. And finally, you had the ability to take over as presenter and control those PowerPoint slides. From a usability enhancement perspective, we changed the snap view. That is, we made that snap view a little more robust and able to snap to different sizes and different structures in the Windows 8 UI.
And show things appropriately,
exactly.
Like just contacts or whatever the case may be.
Exactly. It did become localized into 51 separate languages, and it had a set of improved accessibility features, so it was more compliant with screen readers and high visibility interfaces. And finally, we brought into that same thing link to Skype Federation, so it was finally possible in that Windows 8 client to IM and to voice with a Skype contact just as it would be in your PC client. We've just got a couple of screenshots here to show you what that anonymous join looks like. It's interesting to note that that anonymous join allows anybody running a Windows 8 client to download the store app and click to join a meeting and simply be able to look in their calendar, find the meeting invite join link, paste that in, and then give themselves a name and simply said join a meeting, I'm a guest. From the meetings environment, what we really gave you was this new button here in the interface.
The tile isn't blank anymore.
Called Meetings. And it pops you over to this sort of calendar view of the environment that's highlighted the link meetings in blue and the non-link meetings in gray. It's interesting to note here that the non-link meetings in gray may have link information in them, and you can, in fact, click on those link join links, but they won't show the same join button on that interface, and those are generally meetings that come from federated companies or companies that aren't your own. We gave you the ability to take over as presenter. This is something where you can see that that one of the other participants in this meeting has taken over and is now choosing to go ahead or snap backwards in the meeting and view some of this content, you know, as we say, you know, to take notes. Maybe he missed something and wants to go see, hey, I missed what the detail of that pie chart was. Let me go back and look at that.
Right, and it's also possible for somebody else to upload the slide deck and with the Windows 8 client take over and actually present, be the presenter, where that wasn't available before.
Most definitely. It is still a limitation of the client that you yourself can't share PowerPoint or interact with those things in the client, but that's sort of a functional API limitation. We updated the snap view of the client such that it snaps much more cleanly and nicely in the interface, so you can have a much sort of more robust interface to viewing just the contact list in that manner, and it's much more interactive. The search interface looks right, but it's also able to pop out and interact with the Snap UI appropriately. So now we jump over to Link Mobile 2013 and what we've updated since that product was released. We generally break that into three sort of buckets. We had that meeting enhancements, we had those usability enhancements, and then we added that link to Skype Federation contact in there. So in the meeting enhancements, we really moved to be able to view shared content on those mobile devices, and that moves all the way down to those small form factor Windows phone devices that are able to consume desktop sharing or consume PowerPoint sharing when they're, you know, in a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Invite and remove conference participants. So it really is the case that Link Mobile is now a first-class participant in the meeting and can interact with and control the meeting just like any other client. The ability to simply click to rejoin a meeting is a really powerful one. Whether you get dropped off the meeting or choose to leave the meeting to interact with something else, it's very nice to be able to come in, see that meeting in your conversation history, and simply rejoin it. And honestly, the ability to mute and unmute somebody other than yourself when you're in a conference as a presenter, it was a huge add to the mobile client in my world. basic usability, we gave you the ability to transfer a call and then to delete all the conversations on that Windows Phone mobile client. It was a really nice one. From an IT admin perspective, though, one of the things we added was the ability to control this from a policies and preferences perspective. So we've given you the ability to enable mobility at a global, a site, or a user level. We've given you the ability to configure enterprise voice for mobile users. So you can choose whether to allow those mobile users to do voice over IP or not, or simply allow them only to do call via work or those single number reach features and sort of drop them back to a Link 2010 world. These are decisions you get to make based on whether you understand your users to have data plans and be able to take those additional data costs on, or if you're in regions that in fact give the user a better price structure for received calls than placed calls. We gave you the ability to limit data usage by employees. That is, we can push down by policy that those clients will respect whether we're going to require Wi-Fi for IP audio or IP video.
So the fact that we can be VoIP enabled for the users, but you can only use it if you're on Wi-Fi. So in theory, there would be no cost associated with that.
Yeah, it's a nice ability for us as the IT admins to control and push that out by policy. We can block push notifications. That is, if for some reason your users don't like the way that push notifications work on their client or don't want to be interacted with in that way, you can in fact push that out and block those abilities. The thing to note, though, is by disabling that, you would block the ability to receive VoIP and IM calls when that application is in the background. And this was a huge ask. This last one was a huge ask that we got from our customers, was policy to disable the logging and saving of call and IM information on those mobile devices. And it works across all those clients, but that's the important thing to remember, is turning this on enforces it on your PC and the interaction with Outlook, as well as on the mobile device and the interaction, saving it locally there. Moving on, we have a few additional preferences. We can, in fact, allow or prevent the mobile devices from saving those credentials. So if you're in a highly regulated, highly secure environment, you want to prevent the mobile device from signing in if they don't know the user's corporate password, you can prevent that by preventing it from being saved on the mobile. But remember, if you do that, whenever that client leaves the foreground, it's going to become signed out, and the user isn't going to be able to receive those background calls and notifications. They're going to have to initiate all those communications. We gave you the ability to disable exchange connectivity from the mobile clients, and this really interacts with some of the new features on the most recent release of the mobile client that turns on a feature we call passive authentication. Since Exchange doesn't understand passive authentication, once you drop into a mode for passive authentication, you really have to turn off the Exchange integration features on the PC client and the mobile client. Otherwise, you'll start getting interaction errors on the client. And it's really to turn those features off rather than let the user encounter problems trying to use them. And then simply this last one, require Wi-Fi for sharing, interacts with data usage for your employees. Again, content sharing can be a huge data hog and can push some pretty high costs onto your end users. We'll cover that a little later in this course. Again, for the user themselves, if you as the IT admin haven't pushed those policies, those same things are able to be done by the end user in the settings of their mobile client. So they can specify how they want to require or not require Wi-Fi for voice, video, sharing. They can turn up push notifications on or off for those IMs on the Windows Phone platform. They can interact with whether the Link client can interact with their phone book or whether it's turning photos on or off. One of the first features here was specifying your mobile number. That was a feature that came in the Link 2010 client, and it enables that callback to the end user.
And that's great for if you're on an iPad or something of that nature that doesn't even have the ability to receive a call.
Yep.
But if you did get a call, your mobile phone that you have may be the one that rings.
Yep. And you can configure and administer all that from the Link client on those mobile platforms. Mm-hmm. And lastly, you can turn on TTY modes for the accessibility. which is a good one to have. Sort of, it was a requirement that we needed to really fulfill within the client to make it TTY and hearing aid compatible. We're moving on to the architecture and scenarios portion of the of sort of what we talk about when we talk about Link 2013 mobile. From a deployment perspective, what we're really talking about is the different components that are around that interact with this. And you see we've got a large sort of set of pieces of this environment. But we have to really talk about how this changed with UCW API rather than the MCX service. And it really comes down to there's this first thing where the mobile client interacts through the reverse proxy in a discovery process and then is directed through that discovery to whichever pool they're interacting with. And that pool that they're interacting with, in fact, forwards them off to the forward proxy for that and then off in through the edge for that mobile notification, right? So it's interesting to see how that mobile client gets redirected and moved around in those different modes. But it is important to know that the Link 2013 mobile client, whether it's mobile on iPhone, mobile on Windows, mobile on Android, is a full UCWA. That is, it's always interacting through the reverse proxy, and it's never itself talking directly to your edge service.
Right, except for audio and video communication, media relay.
Yep.
Right. Okay. And so if, in fact, your reverse proxy or your communication, how you're getting that in, does not work, mobility will not work.
Right.
Right.
Right. No, it is a little different from what you might see on a Link client, a Link FAT client on the edge. It can sign in whether reverse proxy is working or not. It has some limitations to the functionality, but it can at least perform those sign-in functions. When we're receiving a VoIP call, the flow here is really the scenario we've got is that Alice is logged into a Windows phone that has the client has the pgit event channel established with the UCWA, and the application is in the foreground, right? We're just talking about how this push notification works. So Bob attempts to contact Alice, right? So Bob says, I want to call Alice. That notification goes from Bob's pool through to Alice's pool, which sends the notification out through the edge. The edge talks on a Windows mobile platform again, talks through the SIP Federation into Link Online, which goes through the PNCH service, which pushes down into the end user through that mobile push notification service into Alice. Now Alice is receiving that VoIP call, and the call, when she accepts it, drops again back through that reverse proxy to establish that media path, and then it establishes that media path and the connectivity through the edge into Bob.
Directly to Bob.
Yeah. Exactly. So media bypass, not really, but it's point-to-point communication between Bob and the edge and point-to-point communication between Alice and the edge.
Yeah, and it's important if it was a conference that the person they would be talking to would actually be the pool server, the MCU, not the program. But same concept. You're talking your phone directly, unlike any of the other clients, directly to the endpoint.
Yep. So when we're talking about voice call preferences and we turn on require Wi-Fi, what does that mean for the environment? It means we've got this same scenario of Bob contacting Alice, but Alice is now moved from Wi-Fi connectivity to LTE connectivity. Alice's setting is now required Wi-Fi for VoIP. Bob attempts to make a call to Alice. That same thing looks. It waits and figures out what's going on that pool. That's the UCWA, which tries to notify Alice's communication, but in fact says Alice can't receive that communication. It doesn't even ask. Alice, by turning on that setting, has pushed that flag back into her user profile in the database so that when Bob attempts to make that call to her, it fails back, falls back to PSTN, and attempts to call Alice on her configured mobile reach number. Again, we flow that call back through the PSTN and into her mobile reach number because she is either configured via policy for that mobile access or has manually configured that for herself. Again, she has the same interaction. She can answer that call. Now the media flow is happening through the PSTN and never touches the edge.
So also, it's possible, and this same scenario happens, if you are enabled for push or to receive a call on whether it be Wi-Fi or not, so you're theoretically capable, but maybe your Wi-Fi connection just simply couldn't establish itself well, poor connectivity, it's not on, the UCWA client or API will attempt to contact you over that initial communication, wait, if there's no response, start the same ring process.
Yeah, right? Starts that same process, even if you are configured to allow that call over Wi-Fi and you're still on Wi-Fi, but Wi-Fi may be intermittently connected or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about Link Mobile on Wi-Fi, though, you bring that up, it's important to look at what the characteristics and the codecs are that this supports and sort of how this happens in the Link client. That second point there is important to remember, though. In an active call, we don't have any handover between networks. So if you are on Wi-Fi and you drop off Wi-Fi onto some 3G or 4G or GSM connection while you're moving, your Link client will in fact disconnect that call and you'll have to rejoin that call.
Right, and from a very basic technical perspective, your endpoint IP changed, we lost you.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah. But the client should have a rejoin or reconnect as option as well, and so if the mobile client were to reconnect, it would use its new data connection to make that call and off it would go.
Yep. So the characteristics of that mobile client, it really supports most of the codecs that we sort of commonly see in Link. It's nice to see that G711 is supported, G722 is supported. It's interesting to note that we still drop down to Siren for P2P audio. RTA is not supported in the Link mobile client. It is supported in the store app or the modern Windows 8 client, though. It is noted that H.264 is supported for video. Hardware offload, though, only happens strangely on the mobile phone 8 platform, not on the Windows 8 or iPad or iPhone.
Right. And so it has the ability to have the additional video chipsets to help us make the video process better, which in theory would make the video experience better on the Windows Phone 8 platform.
Yep. RT video is only supported when legacy clients are connected, so that's the only time you'll get that RT video interface. So the Link client on your mobile platform really operates very well, either in foreground or background mode. It can keep the call up when in a background call. But the interesting thing to remember there is video does get switched off when you drop into background mode on that Link mobile client. When we're talking about iPad 3 characteristics, what we really are trying to show here is what the impact of Link Mobile on an iPad is to video life, or to battery life, and how much battery and data we're expecting to see on that environment. So we know that iPad can really send up to QVGA, quarter VGA traffic at 15 frames per second, and it can receive up to full VGA or 360p at 15 frames per second.
Yeah, and a large part of that has to do with the CPU and the encoding process, and it's just the limitations or capabilities of the hardware that we're on. We push as much as we can, but the limitations are exposed by the hardware itself.
Yep. Our experience and our testing showed that battery drain time from 100% to 0% on that platform when doing IM and conference-based app sharing, we got that up to about 9 hours of sort of usage. And when doing IM plus app sharing with a video in a conference, we really got it, you know, closer to about 6 to 6.5 hours. So it's interesting to see how the Link mobile client on those platforms affects your battery life.
Oh, yeah. And because the iPad has such a big battery in comparing to, like, a mobile phone, you're going to get much better life and amount of time out of the client when using it, whether it be app sharing, whether it be that you're doing video, IM, whatever the case may be. But battery size does play a part in how long we can do these things. So,
yep. From a data usage perspective, these are benchmark numbers. You know, your testing may prove them to be a little different, but our testing showed that IM plus app sharing in a conference got you to about 766 megs in 9 hours, or an average of about 189 kilobits per second. Once we add video to that, you'll see it jumps way up into nearly 800 kilobits per second. of traffic across that 6-hour video stream. And it's good to know that video, when doing that, is going to vary greatly based on the amount of data change in that video as it's being sent. When we're looking at the same thing from an iPhone 4 perspective, what we found was that the iPhone 4 had a very similar set of characteristics from the video sending and receiving characteristics. Mm-hmm. Still sends that QVGA at 15 frames per second, still receives either VGA or 360p. Battery drain time here is an interesting one. So I am an audio person to person, up to 8.5 hours of, drains us from, goes from 100% to 0%. Whereas video, we really only get up to about 3 hours. But it is nice to know that our video and FaceTime have about the same battery impact.
Right. It's not so much the application. It's the fact that you're running the video processing back in that's just sucking up your battery life.
Yep.
So mobile phones and video, they don't play as well together from a battery perspective.
Right. From a data usage perspective, IM and video in a conference, what we found was 690 kilobits per second average. So it's good to remember that when you're rolling these out to your end users, that how that is going to impact their data costs.
And the exact reason why those policies exist, because if you're not on an unlimited plan, and there aren't many anymore, it's going to cost.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we get into that a little later. What does it cost?
We do. So Android, we're doing the same characteristics on an Android. So we can send, again, up to QVGA. We can receive it up to VGA and 360p. It's good to notice that with a Qualcomm 8x60 or 8x60 chipset, that they can send up to full VGA at 15 frames per second.
Yeah, so those newer, with the new Snapdragons that are within it, have the ability to actually, and again, it's all processor power, so it has more and it can do more.
Yep. So we didn't really have any info at this time about what the battery drain was. And a lot of that was the different manufacturers and the different phones. There's a panoply of different Android phones out there, so it was really hard for us to get a benchmark of what the characteristics of sort of battery life were on those different platforms. But from a data perspective, we did see about the same thing, that we saw about 690 kilobits per second when you're doing basic video, but that other chipset allowed us to do a little different. We actually were sending better video, so we actually increased the bandwidth that was needed.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're looking at Windows Phone 8, as we're sort of moving through these different mobile platforms, we can see that Windows Phone 8 sends up to 424 by 240, and it receives up to 640 by 480, but it has full hardware offloading. So it is interesting to note that battery drain time for these phones is, quote-unquote, between 2 to 4 hours on Wi-Fi and between 2 to 3 hours on Wi-Fi for video. On 3G, it's between 1 to 2 hours. So it's interesting to note the difference in terms of what this looks like.
Yeah, and it comes back to there's different phones, different manufacturers, different battery sizes, and what one phone may have from a battery length is going to, or could be, and is different than other manufacturers, but they're running the same operating system. The number of Windows phones is fewer than the Android market, so it was possible to do some benchmarking in a totality type of manner, not so much on the Android side.
Yeah, and from a data usage perspective, really we get to some actual pretty good numbers. We're a better number, and a lot of that has to do with that hardware offloading. We're able to compress that signal and send less data across the network for processing on the server. So we did a quick calculation here from a cost on a 3G network. So joining a conference on your iPad with audio and video and app sharing used on average 358 megabytes an hour. Sprint, as a benchmark, charges $20 US for 2 gigabytes, or $50 for 6 gigabytes. So we're expecting that 16.75 hours of conferencing would cost you about $50 on your iPad from a data usage perspective.
That could be one or two conferences.
One or two days worth of conferences.
Yeah.
So it's important to know that joining a conference using 3G instead of Wi-Fi is going to make a difference and will drain your battery at a much higher and much faster rate than the other way. So it's important to remember if you're dropping back down to 3G, it's going to pretty definitely impact your battery lifetime.
And the cost.
Mm-hmm. And you may be better served in those cases where you are on 3G to drop your client into not receive over that 3G signal and instead force it over Wi-Fi or call via PSTN. Mm-hmm. So from an impact on your mobile devices perspective, this is really about you understanding when you're rolling these things out to your end users and rolling these features out, simply taking these things into perspective. Doing voice over IP and video on your mobile device does affect battery life. You can't expect or you can't sort of tell your users to expect the fact that they can make these video calls or voice over IP calls and it have no effect on their battery life and their performance of the phone. Users will expect great audio and video quality, but we're relying on the quality of their 3G, 4G, or Wi-Fi network to produce that great audio and video quality.
Right, and that's the Wi-Fi one and the quality of the Wi-Fi is such a variable in a lot of organizations. So while internally you may have this amazing enterprise Wi-Fi solution and everything is configured per the recommendations of Microsoft, the control you have over the user's home networks when they're trying to participate or telecommuting, and rather than being plugged into their home local router, they decide Wi-Fi is the way to go, and or two of their children are on two different Xboxes and their wife's streaming Netflix and sucking off all the network, you can expect impacts to happen on your network. So the quality is only going to be as good as the network that you're controlling.
Most definitely. Or if you've got users who are traveling off to remote locations, they're traveling off to their local coffee shop with Wi-Fi, you can't guarantee them a great audio or video signal there.
You can't guarantee anything when you're in a coffee shop, any brand that you may be at. Exactly. Yeah.
Remember, though, that a mobile device can also be a laptop or a tablet. So those things are still impacted by that. So when we're saying mobile device, we're really talking about how the user is consuming the service, not necessarily the device they're consuming the service from.
Right. If you're mobile, if you're not on the corporate network plugged in with a LAN cable to the switched network.
Yep. And laptops, tablets can be on 3G, 4G connections, be on Wi-Fi, and you should still think of them when you're talking about designing your mobile strategy. Truthfully, though, going mobile means investing in your network. You can't really go mobile and do a BYO environment without investing in a robust Wi-Fi, a robust LAN, a robust edge network, and really doing some testing and understanding what those things bring. We move on into troubleshooting tips here, and we're really sort of trying to give you a little bit of good guidance on how to troubleshoot sign-in and how to troubleshoot these things as they're coming through your network. Troubleshooting steps are pretty basic, right? These are your basic troubleshooting steps. What are the symptoms? Is the symptom they can't sign in? Is the symptom they can't make an audio or video call? Is the symptom they can't join a conference?
And this is not uncommon, right? This is not uncommon that from a troubleshooting perspective, that a ticket or a call or whatever, however you've received this issue, the client has the answer for you and they're telling you what you need to fix. Whereas 90% of the times, what is the symptom? That's where we need to start at. What's the problem?
Yeah, don't tell me how to fix it.
Tell me what the problem is. And once I know what the problem is, I can triage it and diagnose what's the issue. But always start with, no matter, I don't care if it's Link Mobile, I don't care if it's Exchange, or if there's a leak in your water faucet. You need to find what is the symptom. The symptom is the leak caused by what, right? Yeah. So,
and then you have to really look at what are the scenarios that you're dealing with. So when somebody says they can't sign in, you have to look at, does that mean they can't sign in on a specific mobile device, a specific platform of mobile device? Is it a global sign-in problem versus a desktop or a mobile sign-in problem? You have to figure out if it's affecting only peer-to-peer calls but not PSTN or conference calls. And lastly, is it reproducible? Right? It's really hard for you as a troubleshooter to try and troubleshoot something that only happens once. So when we're talking about what to look for, you kind of have to break up the signaling versus the media. And what we're talking about, remember, earlier we talked about the components involved in a mobile deployment and that signaling is going to follow a different path than the media in a lot of these calls. So from a signaling perspective, what you have to really remember is all mobile clients communicate using UCWA and HTTPS, and it's only SIP that happens on your network. So your mobile client outside on the edge is talking through HTTPS into the UCWA, which is talking SIP into the front end, which is then potentially talking to an edge server, a mediation server, a link desktop, or back to UCWA. That flow of traffic is HTTPS from the signaling or from the mobile device, translated in SIP from the front end to an edge server where we're dropping into SIP and SDP, standard ICE negotiation kind of pieces. That same communication flows back the same way, but it is interesting to note this mode then drops into what we have for a push notification that goes out, right? Mm-hmm. None of this handled that push notification, but that push notification is out there. Depending on how that call flows or what the user is attempting to do on that mobile, we may interact with that push notification and push something back out to the user to receive that call.
Yeah, and in the Link desktop client, there was a change that allowed clients that were active on a mobile to be identified as being a mobile client within the Link client, which helps. Keep in mind that when you're contacting a Link client and they may be going through this whole mobile process and we've got to be notified, I've got to click it to answer, it's got to bring it out of sleep from the background, it's not necessarily the same start experience, and perhaps a little bit of leniency would be nice for some people. And same with even an instant messaging communication, because it is flowing differently. There are other pieces involved. And your connection being on whatever that happens to be has a great impact, and you don't know what that is. So
when we're looking, though, from a media perspective, we have to remember that we're doing these ICE negotiations inside the network, and those probably are going to impact how that call flows. It has so many more moving parts that flows through all these pieces. A Link desktop user who wants to talk to a Link mobile user from a media perspective flows through a Link desktop, which is potentially NATed to your edge, which is talking to the front end, which is talking a Link. So this is a Link desktop on the outside, right? Talking to edge, which talks to a front end, which talks to the UCWA to find out if it can talk to the mobile, which then may in fact talk to the conference server or the mediation server, depending on how it needs to get there. It's going through the NAT service on the cellular provider down to the mobile device and then back through that same thing to get your media to flow.
So the fact that it even works is fairly amazing.
It is. The big thing to remember, though, there is no such thing as media bypass in this environment. We're not... Your client may be able to do media bypass to its local mediation server, but that's to make the PSTN call. If you're dropping off to that, it's not going to have anything to do with media bypass between. So you could envision this thing where you've got a Link mobile on your corporate Wi-Fi that's got theoretically a local connection to a PC that's making a call. We won't get media bypass in that sense. We'll still send that user on that mobile out through UCWA to make that connection. Mm-hmm. So we're just walking through those flows, and what to look for is whether you can get those connections built and whether that media path is open. How you look for that, though, is by turning on logging. You're going to get a wealth of information simply by turning on logging in your Windows Phone client or in your Android or iPad client, and then looking at those logs. If there's a failed communication, it will show up in these logs. So when you turn on logging on the Link mobile client on Windows Phone, you do have this ability to save logs. When you save that log, though, it's saved as a JPEG. It's important to remember, though, that JPEG that's saved on that mobile device can get corrupted or removed if you use Windows Phone 8 to send that via email. The only way to get that saved JPEG out is to physically tether and get it off via USB sync or on some mobile devices via an SD card or something like that. But really, this gets to that JPEG is in fact a JPEG header text file.
Right. Removing the JPEG or JPG extension, changing it to TXT. Now you've got it with a little goop on top. You've got your file.
Right. In fact, we'd recommend simply using Snooper to read that. Mm-hmm. You can use Snooper to read the log from the Windows 8 client. It's interesting to note here that the Windows 8 client has this little GUID key on the end. That's just a store, an artifact of the store feature and how that link,
where it's at, yeah.
where it lives. But that is the location for your log, Brian's log, anybody's log on the Windows 8 client.
Right. When you're logged in and you do local app data, that's your local app data. So yep. You can always use the prins, local app data prins, and get there.
Yep. And that link, or when we say Snooper, it's really recommended to get the latest 2013 Snooper to open these logs. And it should be able to open the Windows 8 client log or the Windows Phone 8 client log in that JPEG mode. We've got a couple of references here for ways for you to test your remote connectivity that'll spit out some pretty good connectivity information for you, whether discovery is working correctly, whether sign-in is working. One piece of advice, though, use a test user. Don't sign into this interface with your, you know, domain admin who's been link-enabled. Create a test user and change its password after you use it here. There is a download of a version for this, so you can actually download this and run these checks on your PC using your network rather than using the public infrastructure. There's been some blogs published for Link Mobile Troubleshooting for Link Online. Those same kind of concepts, though, apply to Link On-Prem. If mm-hmm. you're doing Link On-Prem, you still need to understand these same things, how to get those logs, how to do that troubleshooting, how to troubleshoot sign-in or things. And then the Link Log blog here wrote a really nice article on how to configure Fiddler to let you trace Link Mobile sign-in
right.
on your PC.
Yeah, if Link Discover is not working or Link Discover Internal is not working, nothing's going to work. And using Fiddler, you can easily see, are you getting 403 bits back, 401s back, mm-hmm. 404s? Are you getting a response at NICE 200? And how it's all processed. And Fiddler is unique in that it has the ability to decode that using an intercepted certificate of sorts.
Yeah.
And so it allows you to have encrypted traffic decrypted for that particular session.
Most definitely. The other thing I've done personally is that same URL that Link Discover attempts, you can point to it with a browser, and it will download a file. You can open that file and actually parse through that file and see the properties that are being sent back for the server. I've had a number of cases where customers didn't have properly deployed Edge or properly deployed sign-in services, and that when you open that file, the thing that gets delivered is internal server names that'll never be reachable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to figure out that all those internal and external server names need to be reachable for the client to actually be able to sign in. That's all we're going to talk about here about mobile in this course. And I wanted to let you guys know about the Link conference that's coming up in Las Vegas in February 18th to 20th of 2014.
That's coming right up.
It is. It is. And you can now register at linkconf.com. Note that registration's filling up pretty quickly, and we'd encourage you all to, you know, come and attend, and we'll have fun there.
Great.
So thank you for joining us for this Link 2013 Ignite Updates and Programs, where we talked about mobility and the updates since RTM. Thanks so much.
Thank you.